Welcome to Simple Living Works, episodes 72 and 73. I'm Jerry Iverson. It's my pleasure to be your host with my guest, John Seeger, President and CEO of Population Connection in Washington, D.C. If you're new to this podcast and would like more basic information about Simple Living Works, please listen clear to the end. If you're a regular, you may want to say goodbye at my cue. In this two-part conversation, John and I talk first about the history of Population Connection, its philosophy, programs, and funding. In part two, we talk about more topics related to population, such as the different policies of China and India, immigration, and much more. Since 1968, Population Connection, formerly Zero Population Growth, or ZPG, has been America's voice for population stabilization, the largest grassroots population organization in the United States, with over 40,000 members and hundreds of thousands more supporters and participating educators. Population Connection advocates for universal, affordable access to birth control, educates today's leaders about global population challenges, and mobilizes Americans who care about stabilizing population. They strive to achieve a sustainable balance between people and our planet. If you're wondering, what does population have to do with simple living? I hope this two-part conversation will answer that question. For more information, visit populationconnection.org.
Can you explain the difference in the immigration policy between that of Population Connection and that of Negative Population Growth, your colleague organization, so to speak, because they are considerably different?
Well, I don't really try to sort out what other organizations do or don't do. I've got enough on my hands trying to figure out what we do. So I'll let them explain themselves and let it go at that. I'll tell you our perspective on this. We take a globalist view on issues of migration, and I think it makes much more sense to think about the issue as migration rather than immigration, because immigration is only half of the story. Why do people leave places to go to other places? Now, I'm not talking about someone who is of considerable means and decides that they might like to go spend some time in Paris. How nice for them, I suppose. I'm talking about the driving forces behind most migration in this world. The vast majority of migration of people in the world consists of people in desperately poor places going to the next almost as poor place in the hope of finding a little food, a little shelter, a little respite from conflict. That's what most migration in the world is. In fact, today, we have the largest number of refugees and internally displaced people on Earth that we've had since World War II. It is a global crisis. That's most of migration. One piece of it, however, is the fact that the United States is a pretty darn nice place, all things considered, for most of us, not all of us, but most of us. And so people do tend to want to come here. If you look over the past generation or so, the largest source of migration to the United States has been from our neighbor to the south, Mexico. In 1970, the average woman in Mexico had 6.7 children. Today, that woman has 2.2 children, a remarkable change. It's come about because of literacy programs, family planning programs that we helped with as a nation, as a good neighbor ourselves, and sex ed programs. Today, there is zero net migration from Mexico to the United States. If anything, there are more people who were born in Mexico returning to Mexico than coming here. There are a variety of factors that have caused that, but clearly this dramatic decline in family size has created all sorts of opportunities in Mexico that weren't there before. So our perspective is the best way to deal with this is to deal with the underlying causes, and that's what we focus on. As for what other people do, I'll let them explain themselves.
Fair enough. Okay, well, thank you for the example of Mexico, but let's talk for a bit about our two most populous countries, because they are using quite different policies for population control, or if you prefer, population management. Until recently, China had for decades used the controversial one-child policy quite effectively. China was criticized because parents more often opted for a male child because they thought the male would be able to provide better for them in their old age. Now, India, on the other hand, chose education instead of coercion for population management, and is now on the road to becoming the most populous country in the world. Does population connection have a position on either of these policies?
Well, let's start with China. We believe, as an article of faith, if you will, that the decision to have children is a personal and private decision, and no government has the right to interfere in it. Therefore, it's shifted recently, although it's not all the way to where it should be by any means, but we oppose China's one-child policy because it's a classic example of top-down management, and worse. It involved, in some cases, reports of infanticide and forced abortion, all kinds of terrible things. And we oppose that, and I met with a senior Chinese official to protest that fact and to make our views known on it. The fact is that recently China has started to ameliorate that policy. They've taken some of the pressure off it. Our view is they should just get out of people's way, period. And in fact, there are great models that have worked much more effectively around the world. When we were founded in 1968, there were only about four countries on Earth that had replacement rate fertility, which simply means a couple having about 2.1 children gets you to replacement rate in a country with decent health care. So there were about four countries in 1968. Today, there are about 90 countries. With the notable exception of China, those countries achieved that through voluntary means. So there's a much better method available. As for India, there's nothing wrong with the general principles that they have followed in recent years. It's the application of them. If you look at India, there are vast differences from one state in India to another in terms of family size, literacy rates, women's empowerment. If they would just invest more in doing the things that they already do in some parts of India, such as the Kerala state, they wouldn't have this tremendous burden of population growth. So they don't even have to look outside their own borders for better examples. They can just look inside their own borders for ways to do a better job than they've been doing, in our view.
Thank you, John. I'd like to move on now to some rather unorthodox, maybe even drastic policies to help stabilize population. For your feedback. So the first one is, should we consider reducing U.S. income tax deductions to just two live births? Or would this be considered too racist?
Well, there are a number of problems with doing that. The first problem, and I don't mean the first in terms of the most important, but just to start somewhere, is it's not happening. You couldn't get five members of Congress out of the 535 to go for that. I don't know that you could find one, maybe, but wouldn't find five. So I'd prefer to deal with sort of the practicalities of things rather than theoretical stuff. But leaving that aside for a moment, the fact is people don't have kids for the tax deduction. First of all, it would be a singularly stupid financial plan. Let's have lots of kids so we can get tax deductions. That won't even cover the diapers, let alone the rest of the incredible costs of having children. They're expensive things, children, I know, as a parent, just how expensive having children is. But third, we want every child to grow up and to have the kind of care, the kind of opportunities, the kind of education, the kind of nutrition, the kind of stable home life that makes for productive citizens. And making things harder for people at the lower end of the economic ladder is just a terrible idea on so many levels. I don't care if those people are green, black, brown, or purple, or white. It's just a bad idea. We need to invest more in children, not less. And when you do that, you have a generation of people who are better equipped in every way to deal with the challenges of life. And as it happens, when that happens, they tend to choose smaller families. So there's a virtuous cycle here that we could follow rather than a vicious cycle.
Good insight, John. Let's move on to another unusual idea. That is sterilization, either surgical or chemical, for serial sex offenders, especially rapists, including military rapists.
Well, that's pretty far afield from our work. So it's not an area that I deal with, but I can tell you, based on my general reading, that these sorts of what you might call draconian, or some would call them cruel and unusual punishments, are just don't make any sense. Rape is an act of violence. It's a terrible crime, and people who commit that crime, once they've been given the due process of law, ought to receive a punishment commensurate with that crime. But that's why we have jails. That's why we have jails, to lock people up who have committed terrible crimes and who are a risk. Well, let's not get into let's not give in to the baser emotions of life. Let's be calm, let's be reasonable, and let's realize that there are some bad people out there who need to be locked up, and give them due process of law and lock them up and let it go at that.
Moving on, you may have heard about a small movement to help women who perpetually have babies and then give them away. And so in one case, this organization offers free, voluntary, long-term birth control or even sterilization for women who continue to have babies and then continue to give them up for adoption. Is this something that you consider to be a reasonable plan? And might we add to that that these same women might be offered free college education, especially if they're unmarried?
Well, there are two different issues here that are sort of embodied in that. The first is the notion of enabling women and men to have access to the reproductive health options that they freely choose to use. And certainly, while sterilization sort of is a kind of a harsh-sounding word, there are many men who opt for vasectomies, and there are many women who opt for tubal ligation. And as long as they are going about that in a free and informed way, and have the right kind of information and aren't doing it under any kind of duress, that's a perfectly reasonable option for people. So that part of it is fine. But the rest of it kind of reminds me of that sort of Reagan story about the welfare queen and these sort of apocryphal, semi-mythic circumstances about some woman somewhere. When you try to track these things down, they never quite materialize. They all turn out to be these sort of bowdlerized stories that don't really add up. We know what to do here. Education, access to services. Be calm, be reasonable, be practical. Don't get carried away by sort of these fitful approaches to challenges. I would generally in life and politics try not to live by anecdote. And so I think all of that is sort of anecdotal notions that lead us in a terrible direction.
Okay, moving on. Malthus is much maligned for his theories about population. Is there any credibility to the Malthusian proposition that if we continue to feed people who can't feed themselves, they will have more children and thereby worsen the food problem?
Well, I feel, well, Malthus has been dead quite a while now, and I do feel badly for the old chap, because I've actually read a lot of Malthus, and he sort of gets something of a bad rap. And it's a little like taking one line out of a long volume and building a philosophy around it. He was a creature of his time, and he noted that there are situations, and there's truth to this, if you don't have sufficient resources to provide for people, terrible things are going to happen. What happened, though, as a practical matter, was this, because two things occurred almost simultaneously that are really interesting, and they both occurred in the late 1960s. That was when the population issue here in the United States really came to the fore, when people started realizing that we're adding, these days, something like 1 billion people to the planet every dozen years or so. We're at about 7.4 billion. And not unreasonably, it occurred to a number of people that this is going to be a problem. Something else happened at almost the exact same time, and that was the work of a man named Norman Borlaug. Not awfully well known, but he should be. Norman Borlaug saved, and his team saved, more lives than any other humans that have ever lived. They deserve credit for saving maybe a billion people from starvation. And for that, by the way, Dr. Borlaug received the Nobel Peace Prize in 1970. And when he received it, in his acceptance speech in Oslo, he said, unless we address questions of population growth, everything I've worked on is just going to be a temporary stopgap. So what happened was, we came to understand at the same time that population growth was growing very rapidly around the world, that there were ways to dramatically ramp up production of food. But the way we did that was through the use of carbon fuels, basically, fertilizers, pesticides, all sorts of things that both have certain negative impacts in and of themselves in some circumstances, particularly around pesticides, but also have been the driver behind climate change and global warming. So, yeah, we can kind of use the seed corn, if you will, here, but it just makes so much more sense to move down the road of practical solutions that involve voluntary family planning. The fact is, we know how to meet this challenge. And some of the debates that we have seem to fail to recognize that simple fact.
Well, I'm glad you brought up Borlaug, because I've spent the last 40 years in Iowa, and we have a pet name for him called St. Norm. And he, of course, is now the underpinning for the World Food Prize, which is given each year in Des Moines. And, of course, it's very controversial, because of just what you said, that while we saved lots of people's lives, we imposed a lot of American technology and chemicals into these other countries and into their agricultural system. So thanks for bringing that up.
Yeah, I would probably say that if you asked a person who was living a subsistence agrarian lifestyle, whose children were very hungry, if they would like to have the opportunity to grow more crops, I think they would say yes, by and large. So I'm not sure it was so much of an imposition on our part, but that's another side to it, I suppose.
Moving on, some fundamentalists use population as a political tool. Fundamentalist Muslims and Orthodox Jews are reported to have unlimited number of children in Palestine to try to force the other out by sheer numbers. Now, in America, we've had similar, though more benign, examples. In the 19th century, for example, the Mormons practiced polygamy, not only for religious reasons, but to claim more land, most noticeably in Utah. Does Population Connection take a position on such practices?
Can you be more specific on polygamy or on people.
Well, let's talk about Palestine and the Muslims in this population battle with the Orthodox Jews.
Yeah, because I don't really I found having one marriage to one woman has kept me busy enough for one lifetime, so I kind of stay out of what other people want to do. I wish them all the luck in the world if they want to go down some other path. But getting back to the central issue here, you do see in many faith traditions remarkable divergence of perspective. If you look, for example, and I'll get to the situation in the Middle East in a moment, but if you look, for example, at the Muslim world, you see as many different variations as you do in what might be called the Christian world, or at least the world where Christians predominate. You have many Muslim nations that are very supportive of family planning and have small families. You have others who don't believe that that's appropriate within the context of their understanding of their faith. So you have tremendous differences there. If you look at Israel, for example, there's a huge divide between more secular Jews and the ultra-Orthodox Jews, who in general have very, very large families. If you look at that very tiny part of the world where Israel is located, the fact is that there's an enormous shortage of almost everything, especially water. And the idea that anybody is going to come out ahead by employing the tool of rapid population growth is just a failed enterprise from day one. It's just not going to work. It's just going to make a bad situation worse. I don't know that anybody really knows how to solve that problem. Shimon Peres once said, former Prime Minister of Israel, when you think something's a problem, you try to look for a solution. Some things are just situations, and lately I feel that that is a situation more than a problem, if only because nobody quite knows what the solution is.
On a personal note, John, Rita and I have two children. We have two grandchildren, and we'll have no more. But we don't hear the expression, stop at two, much anymore. Now, how might we reduce the pressure of parents and grandparents for their children to have more than two children?
When we were founded in 1968, the slogan or mantra or whatever you want to call it, stop at two, was very popular. By the late 70s, Americans had stopped at two. In 1960, the average American family had 3.4 children. If you fast forward to about 1977 or so, that's about 16 or 17 years later, less than a generation, family size in the United States had dropped to 1.8 children. I think the reason you don't hear the stop at two slogan anymore is it's a bit like telling people to wear shoes when they go to Manhattan. Americans have stopped at two children. If you go to a typical younger person, and there are exceptions to every rule, but somebody maybe in their later 20s and say, you know, I really think you shouldn't have more than two children, I think you'll get two reactions. One, they'll be puzzled as to why you're kind of butting into their private life with your opinion. And number two, if they're typical, they're not planning to have more than two children. They may have one or two. A few of them will have three, but it seems to have sorted itself out in this country. That's not the challenge in the United States anymore. We have challenges here. We still have very high rates of unplanned pregnancy, unplanned births, and even though we've made great progress in the last 25 years in reducing teen pregnancy rates in the United States by about 61%, we still have the highest teen pregnancy rates of any developed country. So it makes more sense to focus on the problems we have, not on the problems we used to have.
In that regard, then, do you think that maybe more schools and even churches should be distributing condoms, maybe trying to reduce the stigma of premarital sex?
Well, I think there are a couple of issues here. First of all, education works. Comprehensive, age-appropriate sex education that's based on basic reproductive biology makes good sense. There is a form of program, I don't even want to call it sex ed because in my view it isn't, it's abstinence only, it's sort of the term it goes under. The problem with that is there are certain practices in life from which one should abstain for a lifetime. Shoplifting, for example. I'm in favor of an abstinence-only program for shoplifting. Nobody should ever shoplift. But at some point, most people, for their own reasons, decide to have sex, and that seems like a perfectly fine thing. I wouldn't be talking to you, and you wouldn't be talking to me if nobody had thought to do that. So you need a program that recognizes the realities of it. So the best programs are the programs that are sometimes called Abstinence Plus. By all means, tell young people that there's an incredibly good way to avoid pregnancy and sexually transmitted diseases, and that's to abstain from sexual activity when you're too young to undertake it. So that's one important piece of it. The other piece of it is I think it's great that condoms are available in drugstores you don't have to go up and yell at the person behind the counter that you need condoms. They're right out there for all to purchase. But what's really needed is a much more profound understanding of reproductive health needs. I could give you a specific example. A study was done a couple of years ago by the people at the Guttmacher Institute to try to figure out some of the issues around teen pregnancy. And they found there was a very high correlation among young women who had gotten pregnant when they were teenagers and those who answered yes to the following question. Things just seem to happen to me in life. If a young woman has a stable home life, is doing pretty well in school, is active in all the things that teenagers should be, school activities and sports, and is starting to think about and planning for college, yes, she could get pregnant, but statistically it's much less likely to happen. There's more to this than just sort of flying over a community and throwing condoms out of an airplane and hoping for the best.
Thank you so much, John. Any brief comments in closing?
I would just note that our goal as an organization is to ensure that everyone, everywhere, has access to the information and services they need to make their own thoughtful, informed decisions. If we do that, and if we ensure that women everywhere are fully empowered to decide the trajectory of their own lives, the population challenges will just vanish. They'll just go away. And rest assured, we're going to have plenty of other things to work on, but we can cross that one off the list.
Be well, my friend. Keep up the good
Thank
work.
Thank you. Enjoyed it. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to my conversation with John Seeger, President and CEO of Population Connection, formerly known as Zero Population Growth. You're welcome to share your thoughts on these subjects. Email a message to simplelivingworks@yahoo.com or on our Facebook page or on the Simple Living Works blog. Those addresses are given in the show notes at our website, simplelivingworks.org. Click window number 3. To read the latest responses to all Simple Living Works media, including our new daily Simpler Living Nudge, click the link in the show notes or click your recent comments in window number 5 at simplelivingworks.org. Time to wrap up this episode of Simple Living Works podcast. If you're new to Simple Living Works and would like more basic information, please listen a little longer. If you're a regular, you may want to say goodbye here. Peace. If you haven't subscribed yet, we hope you will now through iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Remember that you can listen to all episodes of Simple Living Works podcast. They're archived twice. Access them at simplelivingworks.org, window number 3. Click Preview, Backup, and choose the episodes you want, with or without show notes. Subscription to this podcast and to our weekly blog are free, and they keep you current automatically when we post something new. Urge your friends to do the same. Remember to like us on Facebook. You can also subscribe in iTunes to my other podcast, the Common Good podcast, which I produce and co-host with Jubilee One Earth Economics. Send us your email address to receive the free monthly Simple Living Works e-news. Thanks to the band Earth Mama and to John Pitney for the music on the show. This podcast is covered by the Creative Commons Non-Commercial Attribution Sharealike license. To learn more about Creative Commons, click on its link on our website homepage. We do not solicit or accept donations, nor do we sell anything. All our resources and services are free of charge. We're an all-volunteer organization. We at Simple Living Works believe that simple living really does work. Voluntary simplicity, choosing to live simpler lives, is a faithful, satisfying, effective, comprehensive way of life. It's not a list of rules nor living on the cheap. It avoids fads, convenience, and deprivation. It's so much more than a hobby. We believe in abundance, that there's enough for everybody's needs, not anybody's greed. We follow the saying, live simply that others may simply live, as our closing theme song proclaims. It's a balance of personal responsibility and advocacy for just public policy. It's more than personal happiness, though that's quite important. Contemporary faith-based simple living is guided by the five life standards of living more with less, the classic by Doris Jansen Longacre. I've discussed these standards in earlier episodes. The mission of Simple Living Works is equipping people of faith to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly. We extend the mission and resources of the nonprofit organization Alternatives, which served from 1973 to 2011. The three parts of our mission are elaborated in text and video, and links are listed in the show notes. We produce a half-hour podcast twice a month, hopefully educational and inspiring for you, your family, and your congregation or group. Until next time, this is Jerry Iverson of Simple Living Works Podcast, wishing you well as we strive to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly. Learn to live simply so others can simply live. Learn to live simply so others can live.